You're listening to the Robert Elms podcast from BBC London 94.9.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Robert Elms Show podcast. I shall be joined a little later by author and now screenwriter Nick Hornby, talking about the movie and education. Plus, Richard Tame, a London Blue Badge guide, has given us a brilliant guide to Covent Garden and Soho, two of our most charismatic neighbourhoods. But first up, along with Jason Solomons, I spoke to rising British actor Stephen Graham. Jason's still here, and I think it's up to Jason to introduce our guest.
Lovely. Well, it is all going to work out, because it's working out very nicely for our next guest, who is an actor that you may be familiar with from Shane Meadows' This Is England. He was the ferocious leader of the pack there that led poor Thomas Turgoose astray in a blistering performance that I think brought him to the world's attention. He's since been in films such as Away Days, who's the author of which we had on this show.
We did indeed.
And he is currently about to come out on DVD opposite a young actor called Sir Jonathan Depp, who plays
I've heard of him.
Yes, he's rather good. The film is Michael Mann's Public Enemies, and Babyface is played by an actor who I don't know if it's a compliment or not to be called a Babyface, but he's a young, fresh face actor, Stephen Graham, and welcome to BBC London.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Are you enjoying all of this? Because it does seem to have happened. I don't know whether because of the way that movies come out, it feels like they're tumbling one on top of the other at the moment.
Yeah, I'm. You know, I've done a lot of work over the past few years, and it just all seems to be coming out round about now. But I've been slogging at it for like over 20 years. Do you know what I mean? I've put me grafting, earned me stripes, and stuff.
Yeah, it takes. I mean, it takes the overnight success takes 15 years.
Yeah,
it takes 15 years.
But
you've also, were in Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York as well.
Yeah, that was
how
a great experience. I put myself on tape in London somewhere and left there at that. And then 3 weeks later, got a phone call. No, actually, it was longer. It was about 2 months. And I'd forgot about it. And then got a phone call saying, look, he'd really like to meet you. Do you want to fly out to Rome on Tuesday? I was like, okay. Yeah, of course.
No, I can't do that. Tranmere at home.
As long as I watch the footy. No, but that's how that came about. Most of my film roles have come about in that weird kind of way. For this Public Enemies one, I got told that he wanted to see me put myself on tape again, but I'd done it at home.
When you say put yourself on tape, because I might have a go at this.
It's not hard to do this, but I'll talk you through it. You just get you get your missus with a little digi camera,
yeah,
and you record your stuff. You record your stuff and then you put it on the internet and send it to the States. But with this one, I had to rob a bank in the scene. They sent me sides and I had to rob a bank. And obviously, there was no guns in the house or nothing. Never is. So I used Alfie's little plastic golf club and pretended to shout to people and get down on the floor. And then all of a sudden, 3 weeks later, I get a phone call saying, look, he really likes it and he wants you to fly out to Chicago.
Did he give you a gun, though, this time?
No, as soon as I got there, he went, I thought you'd done a great read and your tape was fantastic. I was like, really? In our front room, me and the missus with a plastic golf club. There are other videos available of me and the missus with a plastic golf club, but not for your eyes. Please. Mine only. Sorry.
But that is an extraordinary way, I suppose, that acting has got. I mean, that would never used to happen, but it is happening more and more often. So does that mean that young actors such as yourself have a chance of being, you know, in huge Hollywood movies?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, especially with something like This Is England, I think, although it never got a major release in the States, a lot of people in the industry saw it and really liked it. And stuff.
And so they should, because it is, I mean, I think it's a coruscatingly good film.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be a part of that. Especially little Tomo, my little boy.
I saw him last night at the London Film Festival. He's got a new film called Scouting for Boys out, which is very good as well, very shocking as well.
Yeah.
And he's growing up. He's really growing up. He's watching grow up on screen. It's amazing that it was at the London Film Festival 4 years ago. This Is England started, and that was the first time I'd seen him. We'd seen before, but that really was your breakthrough wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd done Snatch and stuff before that, but that was the real, you know, that was the one that I really got to get me teeth.
Why do you think it was such a breakthrough? Is it because the film itself was terrific, but the role that you played as well, it was so shocking, I suppose, and you gave it your all as well.
Yeah.
And you had the key speech as well.
Of course, yeah, and it was something that's, you know, that's very personal to me. I'm mixed race, you know, my granddad was from Jamaica and stuff, and I saw them kind of things happen when I was a kid growing up. you know, that racism element and stuff like that, and the National Front taking over. And my dad's always been into his music ever since I was a kid. He was a bit of a two-tone boy, my dad. He loved Toots and the Maytals and all that kind of stuff.
How funny, we've got a Toots and the Maytals track lined up.
Oh, look at that. See, seamless link. So it was just, you know, I put everything into it, and it was just a great opportunity to work with Shane. We're going to do another four, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
This is England?
Yeah, we're going to do a thing for Channel 4. He's going to shoot four separate little films. Well, I think they're going to be an hour and a half long, and it's like 6 years later what happened to all the characters,
and you're one of them.
Yeah, I come back into it. Yeah, but the scripts are it's so funny, honest to god, it's hilarious.
Because I mean, he's doing funny now, because his latest one, Le Donc, which is about it's hilarious, brilliant. It's kind of, I sort of said to him, well, you've sort of put away darkness for a bit, and he said, well, I've had a baby, it's all quite nice now. But this is England, there's always been that threat running through him, all his films. That Paddy Considine brings it in Dead Man's Shoes, and in Romeo Brass, and you were that sort of figure in this. It was kind of quite did you feel you were sort of in the Paddy Considine role?
No, because I think what happened was Shane and Paddy were talking about it, and Paddy said, I can't play this role or something, and then they were like, well, who can? And then none of them take the credit for it, but they both said my name. And then, because Shane only lives 20 minutes away from us, so before I knew it, I was going to have a little coffee with him and stuff.
That was a part whereby you could, you know, as you said, you'd seen it. You knew that world. You understood all of that. Bit different to jumping into a gangster movie set in, you know, which is more of a challenge to try and get something. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know. To me, acting's, you know, it's just like playing. When we were kids and we ran around the garden and shot each other with sticks and stuff like that, you believed it. So to me, it's just like playing. And if you put everything into it, and you know, the thing with the Michael Mann film is, because his attention to detail is so fantastic, and he's got such a wealth of film knowledge, and he creates this world for you. You literally put your shoes on and you put your hat on and you step onto set and you feel like you're in the 1920s. You feel like you're there.
Where did you shoot? Because you shot it in the places where Dillinger did it, in Chicago itself.
Yeah, we were like a little travelling circus. We'd move from state to state, and everywhere they went, we robbed the actual bank that they robbed and stuff, which was
great. They weren't happy about that. Not again.
Twice.
Not again.
Didn't someone put the alarm on?
No, but that was great. You know, they reconstructed the inside of the bank and everything.
Because he was your original sort of criminal. Well, he was the sort of flamboyant original criminal who robbed places and flout state law by going over the state line. And he'd go, no, you
so
can't get me.
That was just sneaky.
And they were like, damn, we should invent a law whereby that
well,
can
get him.
Yes.
Yeah, that was great. He was a latter day Robin Hood, I suppose.
And what about the accent? How was that?
It was great. With my accents, I tend to spend time with the drivers, because, you know, as you well know, in London, if you were a driver on a film set, he's like, oh, what's Shane doing? I'll put you out in the morning, Shane. Let me take you down. See you half 7 in the morning, Steve. So they're exactly the same when you go to another country. It's like, hey, Stevie, what, come here, I'll pick you up at best 7. So you just, I spend time with them, and that's where I get the ear for it, really.
Did you have a Liverpudlian driver this morning?
No, I was in a taxi. No, I never. This is my own voice. This belongs to me.
Right,
but the Liverpudlian one is very good for the Chicago accent as well. It's very close, and the Gangs of New York kind of era, that kind of Irish. It kind of goes from Liverpool to Ireland to America. Yeah. It goes that way, doesn't it?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, to me, Scousers are just lazy Irish that couldn't be bothered going to America. Off the first boat, they said, "Oh, sack it, let's stay here." You know what I mean? But that's where the influence comes from, I suppose. And it's nice and easy to be able to slip into the accent.
And it's obviously proving very, very useful for you. I know the DVD of Public Image has just come out. Where else can we see you? Who are you working with next? George Clooney?
No, I'm working with Steve Buscemi. I'm playing Al Capone this time.
Oh, get out of it!
I am, honest to God, on my Mars life. Can you believe it?
You've worked your way up the gangster ladder.
Yeah, I am. I'm just gonna take over all them American gangster roles. Martin Scorsese directed The Pilot. It's for HBO. It's called The Broadwalk Empire. And we shot The Pilot. It was $35 million for the first pilot.
On telly,
can you believe that? We could have made 12 This Is England for that. But it looks fantastic from what I've seen and everything.
And we like Steve Buscemi on this show.
Yeah,
we?
Steve Buscemi's great.
Forget making 12 This Is England. You could have bought an entire new forward line for QPR. Well,
I think he's probably needed one for Liverpool.
Who could we buy for Liverpool? Not a new manager. I'll give him a little bit longer, I hope. He'll sort himself out.
Your wife has already entered the conversation, so I know you've got one. So, you know, yeah. Didn't she sort of say, Johnny Depp, just bring him round.
Johnny loves
Johnny. Because mine would have done.
No, she's met him and stuff, and you know, my missus is lovely. She's a lovely woman. She's got a great sense of humour, and she's one of them people that just, she can get on with anyone, you know what I mean? Brad Pitt stood on her bag once, and she... Stood on her bag. We were at the after show party, and he'd met her twice before. No, that was the first time he'd met her. He stood on her bag, and she went, "Hey, you cheeky..." She doesn't speak like a Scouser. No, she said, "Hey, you cheeky..." I paid £50 for that bat from New Look. So, and then that was it, you know what I mean? He was laughing his head off, and then the two of them just kept pulling faces at me all night. But she's one of them people who just get on with anyone. She's lovely.
Well, I'm very grateful. For you, that is obviously, I don't know if you set out to do that as a career. Obviously, one aims one as high as one can. Mm. But when you started, was that in Liverpool Theatre?
I started at the Everyman Youth Theatre when I was 14. As a fantastic actor called Drew Schofield, who's a Scouse man, and he was in Sid and Nancy. He played Johnny Rotten in Sid and Nancy. He's a great actor, and he came along to a school play, and he said to me, "Mum and Dad, I think your boy's got a bit of talent. Why not take him to the Everyman Youth Theatre?" And I did, and touch wood, thankfully, I never looked back.
Yeah, so you keep going and keep going and keep... I'm just thinking sort of advice to other younger actors. Yeah, how do I get away with Johnny Depp?
My advice is just keep going, you know what I mean? Just try and choose good roles and good scripts. Don't just try and do anything, but obviously I understand people have got to make a living, do you know what I mean? But just keep in there, don't never give up, just keep the faith.
And I guess in that case, when the big one comes along, when you do get This Is England and you get that fantastic speech and that fantastic scene, you're ready for it. As you say, you've been grafting for 15 years
exactly,
before that. Because you seize the moment. You think, well, who is this bloke doing this? Well, I think one of the best scenes in British cinema, certainly this century far.
Thank you very much.
But you're good already. You know what I mean? Mm. Your muscles are flexed. You know, acting is a muscle, isn't it? It's got to be in shape.
Of course, you put the work in. It's like you say, it's like an apprentice. I've seen as being an apprentice, and now I'm, you know, it's been a 15-year apprentice, but now I'm really coming into my own, thankfully.
Well, people can see you on DVD in The Public Enemy with Johnny Depp. And when are we going to get to see the £35 million extravaganza? Could have been a forward line
for QPR. Probably not till the end of next year, I think. I think it will be the end of next year.
And you're shooting that in Chicago as well?
We shoot that in New York. Right. I go off the end of next week.
With Scorsese?
Marty's your now executive... Yeah, you mean Marty. He's the executive producer, but he's directed the first episode. Right. It was nice because he just phoned me up and said he didn't want anyone else to play the part of Al Capone, which was very, very nice of him.
It's like entourage. Yeah. Being hanging out with you.
Listen to Robert live on BBC London 94.9. Weekdays from midday or online at bbc.co.uk/London.
Right then, we must turn our attention away from the culinary delights of South London and on to the many and varied delights of Central London, of Covent Garden and Soho indeed, because I have in front of me the illustrated A to Z historical guide to what are certainly two of London's most charismatic and historical neighbourhoods. And here to tell us more about it is Blue Badge guide and writer, and indeed the writer of Covent Garden and Soho, Richard Tame. Richard, thank you very, very much for... thank you very much for coming in.
Good afternoon, Robert.
Not the first time you've been here, sir.
No, not the first time even this year, so...
What was it last time?
Shakespeare's London on 5 groats a day.
Gotcha. And I ate my chocolate groats as well. Thank you very, very much. Covent Garden and Soho, probably, I guess, to London's two most kind of intriguing neighbourhoods, do you think?
Densely packed, I think we might say.
Historically so.
Yeah. Took a bit of unpacking, as you say. I mean, it's a long enough book, but you could have written three times as much. Every street tells a story, and that was the idea of the book, was to take every substantial street, square, plaque, statue, and provide a context for it so that you can walk around and say, you know, what happened here, who lived here, when was it built, how's it changed? That's really the idea. It's a fairly simple idea, but I don't think there's anything quite like it.
There are books about statues,
books about plaques, books about streets. But I think by zoning down onto these two adjacent area, we were able to give it a fairly comprehensible depth coverage.
Adjacent neighbourhoods, but areas, but very different. They've always been, you know, quite distinct. I suppose if you throw St Giles's in the middle, almost between the two, you've got this kind of almost three neighbourhoods, each of a distinct and different character.
My heavens, this man knows his London.
Well, I know a bit, yeah.
Yes, you have. I mean, exempting St Giles, which I don't think ever has had. The other two have both had a distinctly aristocratic element.
No, St Giles
point,
certainly not. No.
Right? But the other two have had this distinctly aristocratic element. It's home for ambassadors, courtiers, painters. And then they've had a sort of raffish.
Fallen on hard times.
Yeah, absolutely. Or interesting times.
Yeah.
But they've also... Soho certainly had quite an industrial base.
Really?
And a craft-based area. A lot of skilled craftsmen. Originally, you know, very top-end silversmiths, gun makers, mirror framers, all those sort of wig makers. Was, and then in the 19th century, things like billiard tables and printers inks and hat making, very different sort of thing. Covent Garden, if you've had, you've had sort of craft shop things, but they've been much related to, of course, costume, the theatre, and supporting that. One realises that if you have big theatrical establishments, as there are there, there's a whole support army needed, and obviously
scene
needs
painters
to be, yeah,
and
I've seen
everything
painters
else, yeah.
As you say, musicians, session men of the day of the 18th century, all clustered and drawn to that, and of course all of these needing their pleasures to be serviced as well.
And servicing and pleasures.
Servicing and pleasures, I think, is the common element between the two.
Because Covent Garden was very much a red light district at one point in its life,
in the
18th
century, yes, it was.
I mean, that was the place of the, yep. of the bagnos and the brothels and the yep. bordellos and all of that.
Yeah, and things that pass themselves off, as you say, like bagnos, which pass themselves off as respectable places to get a bath and a massage, but well, offering ancillary services as well. Coffee houses, coffee shops... restaurants, early restaurants, hotels, as you say, catering for every pleasure and delight.
Now, if you were to pick one bit of each of these two neighbourhoods as for, with the most stories to tell and the most interesting things to see, where would you go? Like a street in each or a square or a corner of one, or where would you go?
Well, the easiest thing is, I mean, I would always start, I suppose it'd start logically in Soho Square.
Yeah.
You know, where there's that funny little pseudo-Tudor thing in the middle. Everybody wonders what that is. It's where the gardeners keep their tools nowadays.
I don't think it was originally that.
No, it wasn't originally that at all. And next to it, there's the story of, I mean, there's Charles II's statue, which has been there and not there and back again. It's been living up in Harrow for best part of a century and then came back to there. And you've got, you know, Sir Paul McCartney's offices are there, and there's the Huguenot Church and the Catholic Church.
They're both French.
The French, the Huguenot Church and the Irish Catholic Church is St Patrick's, which that relates to your St Giles.
Yeah, because that was where the poor of the Irish poor
over
St Giles
the way.
Went. Yeah.
And you've got the House of St Barnabas at the corner, which is the oldest house in Soho, with wonderful plaster ceilings inside, built for a Lord Mayor of London. So, you know, Sir Joseph Banks, President of the Royal Society, lived there, first film censors there, a very posh, the best private school in London up to the 18th century, the
really?
Soho Academy. Boswell right. sent his son there. A very smart fencing academy just off there, Domenico Angelo's. So, you know, you could go round door by door almost there, recruiting office for the East India Company on the south side. Charles II's illegitimate son, Duke of Monmouth, had his house built on the south side. The house of the Speaker of the House of Commons, who was famously cross-eyed, so it was impossible to catch his eye, or you never knew when he did. You know, and then it became a special establishment for flagellants. I mean, so every... Oh, and a new plaque, of course, how can I forget? A blue plaque for Mary Seacole, the greatest black Briton.
So she got a new plaque there,
she's got
because
a plaque
her
there.
Other
yes,
one went, didn't it?
It did indeed. God, this man knows his stuff. What happens to the one just off the Edgware Road?
Yes, absolutely.
That's right, they rebuilt that block, and I thought, why haven't they put it back? That's ridiculous, you know? But they've, as you say, relocated it in Soho Square.
I guess it... one sort of picks one's favourite street in Soho, and you know, Wardour Street's got great stories to tell, and Hammer Horror kind of building. And
well,
all of that
I mean,
sort
Wardour
stuff.
Street was a place that in the 19th century you went for dodgy furniture.
Really?
If you were selling things off as antiques, which weren't. And then, as you say, it becomes the movie street. So for two reasons, people have described it as the street that's shady on both sides.
but my favourite, for whatever reason, I've always liked Dean most, I think. I mean, Dean just has a lot of stories to tell.
Well, it does. I mean, at the top end, you've got the paradox of Quo Vadis, very posh restaurant, with the blue plaque for
Karl Marx
above,
yeah.
And I mean, he
in his garret.
Had a terrible time there. And when he escaped by usual interventions of capitalism, a bit of inheritance enabled him to get out of there, he said he couldn't go past the end of the street without a shudder. So, you know, he definitely had a down on it.
Wasn't De Quincey in that street? Wasn't he in Dean Street, I think?
Yeah, I think you're right.
In Confessions and there was of an Opium
Eater, what is now Royalty House, which pays the royalties to musicians, was the Royalty Theatre, which is this tiny little theatre, you know, which had the first Gilbert and Sullivan, the first Ibsen, the first Juno and the Paycock, I think. I mean, astonishing place in theatrical history. Staggered on one way and another for about 100 years, and then was closed down because there were two film storage places next to it, and they decided the whole thing was going to go up in flames one day, which seemed terribly unfair to the poor theatre in the middle, who was not in any way responsible for this.
Let's quickly go to Covent Garden, because we're going to run out of time. What's your favourite bit of Covent Garden?
I think it's Piazza itself.
Really?
Yeah, I think
quite
so.
Like Seven Dials. But
Now, that's clever, you see. Seven Dials is a very clever... I had to do an architecture course recently, and teach a history of architecture course, and pointed out that by doing that peculiar arrangement of streets, you got the maximum frontages. It was a way of using... It was a Thomas Neal, who was a bit of a chancellor at the court of Queen Anne, got the land. He also should have developed Clarges Street area up in Mayfair, but he didn't have the money for that.
Right.
But that was the... As you say, and that's another area that's gone up and down. An amazing revival.
Because that was a really poor area, wasn't
really?
It? It was a den of
thieves.
Yeah, and
in Dickens' day, he picks that as one of the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
And then it becomes sort of shabby, respectable working. And it's had this amazing renaissance, a retail renaissance in the last 20-odd years.
And then if you go over to the Piazza itself, and obviously the Opera House and the market. I mean, I remember the 1970s when that was a wasteland.
Yes.
I mean, it was a tumbleweed was seen flowing down through Covent Garden.
Yeah,
I mean,
and had certain plans gone through, it
would have been demolished.
Would have been demolished. It would have been a traffic throughway. Everything human would have been 40 feet up in the air above that.
Well, we're rather glad that that didn't
rather
happen,
glad that
I
didn't
suspect.
Happen.
What do you feel about Covent Garden today?
I like it. I really do. And
isn't it a place more for tourists than for Londoners?
Well, it is, but then that's up to Londoners to reclaim it, isn't it?
I guess
particularly, I guess, in the off-season. And certainly you can... I suppose, circumvent whatever your normal route is to make sure you just walk through it and give it a chance again.
I quite like the eastern side of Covent Garden as well, as it veers over towards sort of Holborn and stuff. I mean, that bit, because that's kind of much less touched and much less kind of done up, I guess.
It's true. There's still sort of real old sort of Italian family cafes up around the corner in Endell Street and places like that.
Yeah, I like that bit up there.
Yeah.
Well, it's a fascinating part of London. They both are, Covent Garden and Soho. And if you are fascinated by them, then you should get yourself the Illustrated A to Z Historical Guide, because it does what no other book that I know does. And does exactly what it says on the cover.
Listen to Robert live on BBC London 94.9. Weekdays from midday or online at bbc.co.uk/London.
We must move our attention now to movies, or movies and books, and books of movies, and books being made into movies, and stuff like that. And the man sitting opposite me knows a fair amount about both of those, well, all three if you put music in as well, because he's Nick Hornby. And he's Nick Hornby today because he's done the screenplay to An Education, and he's done a new novel called Juliet Naked, and thankfully we've both got our clothes on. Anyway, welcome to BBC London.
Hi, Robert.
Let's start with the movie, which is An Education.
Yeah.
Which is... Is this your first time of adapting someone else's work for the screen?
First thing that's ever been made.
Right.
There's a couple of things in drawers.
Right.
I think most people who've had a go at scripts have got something in drawers. But the first thing. And it was really a joy to do as well.
How did it come about?
I just read the piece. It was an essay in Granta about 6 years ago now. And, you know, it was Lynn Barber.
An essay or a memoir or a...
Well, it was an autobiographical essay.
Okay.
It was about 10 pages, like a newspaper piece, really, about this affair that Lynn Barber had when she was 16, 17, right at the beginning of the 1960s. And it felt really rich to me, and a lot of great characters. And she sort of fell in with this bohemian underworld that I didn't really know very much about. And it was very precise about the time. You know, it's the 60s, but...
It's pre-swinging, isn't it?
Before the 60s.
Yeah.
And it's kind of amazing.
That era, kind of the 60s before it goes sort of over the top, is one of my favourites, actually. Because you can just feel the flux, can't you? It's kind
absolutely.
Of...
And I think, you know, that's one of the things that this film is about. I was thinking on the way in, if there's ever a film, actually, for Robert Elms listeners, it's this one. Because I think they've done amazingly well, on the time. I don't think
the
there's any detail... wrong, and there's a cameo appearance from Peter Rackman and things like that.
It's a slightly, I wasn't going to say dubious story, but the relationship is one that might be frowned upon by some. Well, certainly it wasn't by her parents.
Yes, I mean, it's an inappropriate relationship. She's, say, a teenager, and the guy who's played by Peter Sarsgaard is Well, he told Lynn he was in his late 20s.
And that was a lie.
And that was a lie. So there was a big age gap. What has really astonished me is that every attractive woman of a certain age who has seen this film comes out and tells me basically that
same
they
thing happened.
The same thing happened.
Really?
Oh, so many. And almost literally, a guy drew up in a car and they got in.
I wish I'd have had a car.
Exactly. I had somebody yesterday said, oh, I had the same, but it was my English teacher. You know, and loads of girls know about this story, and it's no wonder we couldn't get anyone.
Did you have to work with her on it? Or given that it's kind of her life, if you see what I mean, how did you feel about doing that? Because she's not an entirely fictitious character, is it?
No. Lynn was incredibly gracious about it, very supportive, and she understood intuitively that if it was ever going to become a movie, it had to become something else. So I think the first two drafts I wrote, she was called Lynn, and then the third draft, she was Jenny, and I started to...
Kind of distance
a bit. Yeah, distance a bit, and sort of forget, because it constricts you, and I started to forget about the real person and tell the story that I wanted to tell. So it is a combination of adaptation and... fiction.
Has she seen it, you know?
Lynn, yeah. And she,
have you watched it
really
with her?
Yes.
How was that?
It was great. I mean, I think, you know, the moment someone doesn't look like you and the parents don't look like her parents, then she ceases to think it's anything to do with her. But I think she's really enjoying it. She rocked up to the premiere with Tracy Emin and all her arty friends last night, and she seemed to be having a really good time.
How involved do you get when there's a film being made from a script? Are you down there, or are you kind of, do you keep your distance? Or?
Well, this was a strange one because my wife produced it.
Oh, I see. And, well, you can't keep too much distance then.
No, I mean, I couldn't go very often because we got kids, and you know, when you're filming all hours of the day and night, someone's got to be at home. But B, she's bringing it home with her, so I know what's going on a minute-by-minute, day-by-day basis.
So that's an education. Was it on at the London Film Festival, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was on last night, then it opens a week on Friday.
Okay, and as you say, where is it? Is it set in London?
Yes.
With lots of good period details.
Twickenham, and yeah. We got this great cast of Alfred Molina, who hasn't done an English film for quite a long time, playing Jenny's dad, and this girl, Carey Mulligan, who is sensational and I think is going to get an Oscar nomination.
So that's the movie, An Education, which, as you say, is out next week. And then there's the new novel, Juliet Naked. Tell me about Juliet.
Juliet is an album. rather hopeful, putting naked in. But it's naked as in Let It Be Naked. It's an acoustic version of a famous album, except a fictitious album. And it's actually about the relationship between... A musician who's been AWOL since the 80s and...
I know some of them.
Yes.
I thought I was with some of them last night.
That wasn't for want of trying, though, was it?
No.
the musician and the partner of an obsessed fan. So it's kind of like about the internet and Dylanologist type people and English seaside towns and growing old and regretful.
And male obsessions again.
Yeah, there's one guy in it. He sort of disappears after about the first third, but he enables these two people to meet, basically.
Right. Does music still play that as a big light part in your life?
Yeah, huge.
Does it?
Yeah. And I listen to new stuff all the time. And
well, I do, because I have to for work. Yeah. I mean, it gives me an excuse to, because I suspect I would anyway. But don't you find that makes it difficult then to listen? Because there's all those love, wonderful old records that you want to hear, but you just haven't got time because you've got to play all the new ones.
No, I don't think pop music was built to last 30 or 40 years and you listening to it every single day. There isn't that much left in some of those old records for me anymore.
Right.
I love them and I'd never get rid of them. But I don't know, how often do you play I know you're not a Beatles fan.
I'm not a Beatles fan, but how often do I play Blonde on Blonde?
Yeah, exactly,
I don't know.
But you wouldn't ever sell it.
No, of course not.
But it's like the complete works of Shakespeare. It sits there on your shelves.
Not read most days.
Not read most days. And meanwhile, there is amazing stuff around. I mean, you know, you were talking about the singer-songwriter you were just playing. And I've been looking at MP3 blogs a lot recently, which are basically like independent record shops all over the place on the internet, and they're it's not pirating because the bands are joining in, but they all post tracks of their favorite artists. Mm-hmm. And you can download the tracks and get introduced to new music all the time. There's a site called I Am Fuel, You Are Friends, which has introduced me to so much music over the last year.
Does that filter through to does stuff like that, when you're kind of sitting looking at music blogs or whatever, is there a novel building in there? I mean, you know, there's an obvious comparison between a book set on in a record shop and then music. Do you know what I mean? There's kind of,
well, that's that book, Juliet Naked, has partly come out of this. I didn't think I'd write another book about the way we consumed music, but in the 15 years since High Fidelity came out, everything's changed. There are no record shops anymore. Everything is done online, and it kind of partly deals with that, I think, this novel.
Do we miss that?
Well, I've found replacements, you know, that all over the net. I miss, I guess, hanging out somewhere physically.
Yeah. I'm like most of us who are into that sort of stuff. I miss the physicality of leafing through album covers, and because I don't even have an MP3 player. I mean, I don't have a mobile phone either. I've got great Luddite tendencies, and they're laughing at me. They're more than great, they say. But partly it's because I still haven't got my head around the idea of something existing that doesn't have a physical form.
That's,
do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I actually, because there is a collector in me and a filer and all of those sort of things, I don't know what to do with it. I can't feel it. I can't see it. Because I know records by the covers. And when I see a cover of a record, I can tell you where I bought it and when, even though I've got 10,000 of them or whatever.
I think, you know, one of the interesting things about books and music is they are really manifestations of our taste, and we need them around the house.
Of course you do. Just to remind yourself or other people who might pop by.
Who you are. This is who I am. Yeah. Look at the shelves. This is who I am. Yeah. And I think it is weird to have who you are wrapped up in a little box and hidden somewhere. And, you know, if
and reduced to a series of digits or
exactly,
whatever they are.
And if e-books take off, how are we going to tell people who we are? That's why I can't.
You see, that's why clothes are important, because you can't digitize them. You see, I've always been into clothes as well.
Oh, they'll find a way of digitizing them. We'll be emailing each other trousers soon.
If my wardrobe ends up in a little thing I'll be very worried. You're clearly in a good place at the moment. You're enjoying yourself?
Yeah, it's been an amazing year for work. Things that I've been doing for a long time suddenly have come together.
Though.
Yes. I mean, the movies, an education I've been working on for 6 years, this novel I've been writing for 2 years, and they both come out pretty much exactly the same time. Got a radio comedy series on the BBC in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. What's that about?
It's Mark Williams playing the richest man in Britain. He's a sort of Midlands Roman Abramovich with nothing to do all day.
I would say you could buy a Queen's Park Rangers, but they've already done that.
yes. And I've been doing this album with Ben Folds as well, where I'm writing the words and he's writing the music.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun at the moment.
What about Arsenal? Are they fun at the moment, or are you going, or are you not
going?
Yeah, going.
It is fun. They still have a glass jaw, I think, like last night.
But how have you taken to the new stadium and all of that business?
Well, I mean, everything's better and nothing's as good.
Yeah,
basically.
I know exactly that feeling about most things in life, actually.
Yes, it's true. Yeah.
But because, you know, although I'm a Queen's Park Rangers fan, I sort of grew up in North London, so most of my mates are gooners, really.
Yeah, and do they say the same thing?
Yeah, they do. I mean, a couple to the point of just not going anymore, really. But most still go and say, yeah, the food's better and this is better and I've got
the
a great seat.
Better,
and
yeah, absolutely.
All that sort of stuff. The bill isn't better. You know.
The bill is sensational. I mean, it's just incredible how much they charge. But I think it remains to be seen what it will feel like if and when they win something. Because that stadium's been quite an unhappy place so far.
Because, you see, as a Queen's Park Rangers fan, we've it's funny all this, because I've got a 13-year-old son who's been going to Queen's Park Rangers since he was 3. And he's been taken a couple of times to Arsenal with mates, you know, got tickets and he's gone with them and things. And he's been to a couple of other big grounds. You know, we went to Man United with QPR last year and we went to Chelsea twice. Lost all of them, of course. And he said to me the other day, because we're suddenly doing rather well, he said, Dad, I don't know if I want to go up to the Premiership. He said, A, because, you know, we just become cannon fodder, essentially. But B, I don't think I like it up there, he was
saying. No, and I understand that. I don't think it's very cool, actually, the Premiership. In a way that
it's kind of corporate and all of that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wrote a teen novel a couple of years ago, and I was going to... this kid has a relationship with Tony Hawk, the skateboarder, in it. And I... when I started writing, I thought it was going to be a footballer. But then I thought, do teens really idolise footballers in the way that we did, in the way that you did with Stan Bowles and I did with Charlie George? It was a subcultural thing, and now you just see those people everywhere, on every advertising hoarding.
You know, you'd have enjoyed this. Stan came on the show the other day. It was my 50th birthday.
Right.
And so I got Stan on as my guest of honour, right? And he was Stan. He was fantastic. He's great company. And at the end of it, he was going to meet Charlie George in a pub. He was going to have a beer with Charlie George.
All the misfits had come out. Alan Hudson was probably there as well.
Absolutely. Yes. I just thought, what a wonderful meeting. These sort of old, long-haired, miscreant footballers sitting in a pub, chin-wagging.
People who should have played for England more.
Absolutely. Well, there's a new novel called Juliet Naked. There's a new book, An Education, and you can buy the screenplay of the book as well, which will be an education. And Nick Hornby, as ever, it's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for downloading my podcast. Don't forget, you can join me live every day, Monday to Friday, from 12 to 3.